Ajahn Brahmavamsa's talk about meditation was recorded last year in the Adelaide Hills during a meditation retreat.
What am I doing here? What did I let myself in for? It's a very good question to ask. Why am I here? What am I doing? It's a question I asked when I was a young monk, going over to very poor parts of Thailand, eating very coarse and gross food, being eaten alive by mosquitoes, enduring very unpleasant hot weather. It wasn't, certainly wasn't a holiday camp in the monasteries of northeast Thailand. And I often used to ask myself, what am I doing here, giving up so much? And I answered myself, I said, I'm here to be enlightened. That's what I went to Thailand for, to become enlightened. And I became a Buddhist because I'd rejected the idea of a God. No one really knew what God was and was supposed to believe in, or her faith, or whatever. The problem was, though, that when I reflected as a monk, what am I doing here in Thailand? I'm here to become enlightened. I had no idea what enlightenment meant. So I asked the teacher, and I asked other monks, looked in books, and again I could never get a straight answer. You ever got a straight answer when you asked what enlightenment is? And it started to dawn upon me that it was no better than believing in God. Believing in enlightenment, and going through all this pain and agony of a meditation retreat to try and get enlightened. When we start to look about what we're doing here, why are we meditating? Instead of looking at enlightenment, which is like heaven, which is like God, something we really can't grasp, some pie in the sky idea, let's bring this meditation down to earth. Why are we meditating? Let's say we're meditating for peace, for clarity, for compassion. That's something which is very easy to understand. Not like enlightenment or becoming one with God or union with God or any of this sort of stuff. To see the Buddha, and that's just a whole load of rubbish because it's not down to earth. There's nothing we can really understand or relate to. We're meditating here for peace, for clarity and compassion. So when we're sitting down cross-legged on the meditation cushion or on the chair, is it producing peace, clarity and compassion? Or are we getting tense? So often in a meditation retreat, people push themselves so hard to sit down throughout the whole of the 45 minutes every session, even though it kills them. That's not what you're meditating for. There's a great masochistic tendency in Westerners, is if you torture the body, you free the soul, which never works. The Buddha always taught about the middle path, because we're meditating for compassion, to be kind to the body, to become kind to the heart. You push yourself so hard, the Buddha said it's like a person with a guitar who tightens the strings too tightly. You can't get a decent sound out of it. The way to play and have a good guitar is to have the strings just taut enough, but not too taut. In my experience, that most Westerners meditating, their strings are far too taut. They're trying too hard. So it's a good time to talk about compassion, because compassion loosens the strings. Kindness, compassion, what does that mean? The door to my heart is always open to you. No matter what you do. Even if one of you gets up here and said, that's really stupid, this Buddhism, this meditation, It's awful talks. It's an awful meal today. Three. It's awful this and awful that. Bed's too hard. Can't stand it any longer. Say even then that the door to my heart is still open to you. Thanks a lot. Now, in the Buddhist meditation on loving kindness, one starts by being kind to oneself, first of all. And the reason behind this is that, I know with me anyway, that the person I'm closest to is me. Even though that you're married to a husband or to a wife, you've got children, you've got friends, the person closest to you will always be you. And most of our life we spend by ourselves. In meditation, when you close your eyes, who are you with? You're with you. When you're out in the desert, you're not alone, you're not without anyone, there you are again. That's why a lot of people are lonely. They don't like being by themselves because they've never learned how to be kind to themselves. They're afraid of themselves. They don't know how to be at peace with themselves. When you get sick and when you die, the last person you're with is with yourself. And when you're sick and dying, you spend a lot of time with yourself. So it's very important in our lives to become friends with ourselves, to develop kindness, compassion and love to ourselves. It's the same in Buddhism, just as a mother would love her only child, so too to love oneself to that degree, to care, to be kind, to be soft towards oneself. But I noticed in my life that if ever I say anything, or do anything, or even think anything, it affects me first of all. If I get angry at someone, it passes through me first of all. I feel that anger before the person I'm angry at. If I shout at someone, I hear it first. Whatever I do, whatever I say, whatever I think affects me first of all. I can't avoid it. And I know that I have a responsibility to myself to care. Because if I don't care for myself, I'm going to end up a very despondent, negative, depressed human being. Afraid, guilty. That's no use to myself or anyone else. I'm in my care. That's the message. I am in my care. So I know I have to look after myself. To be kind to myself. To be forgiving to myself. To let myself be. You know what it's like sometimes when you go to work and have a hard day at work and you make mistakes and people tell you off. Really stupid what you did today. It's really bad. And we're employing you. This is important. We can't afford to waste this sort of money. And you come home. When you come home, your husband starts telling you off because you're late or because you didn't get the groceries. Isn't it awful that in this world outside where there is so much criticism, when we come home, we get more criticism? And isn't it even more depressing and more terrible when we come home to ourselves? But again, this is criticism. Oh, you shouldn't have done that. What a stupid, horrible day it is today. When am I ever going to learn? Even in our inner home, inside ourselves, we still are criticizing, still putting ourselves down, still feeling guilty, still feeling depressed. What a terrible thing that is when we haven't got a home. It was a wonderful thing for me to have a home when I was a young adolescent. I could go to my home and my father wouldn't criticize me. No matter what I had to do outside, I could relax at home. When I was with my friends, you know what it's like being an adolescent. everyone is criticizing. You have to live up to such ideals as a young girl. You have to be beautiful and charming. As a man, you have to be strong and always saying the right things. It's such a burden, always having to prove yourself. When I went home, you could relax because there was nothing to prove there. And it's a wonderful thing that there are such beings as saints in this world. And I was very fortunate going to a place like Thailand where there are still many monks, there are such saintly beings. And when I first started to tour around and visit these very famous monks, at first I was a little afraid. Because all these famous monks were great meditators. There's no doubt in my mind that they could read my mind. And I didn't really want to let them know what I got inside. It's like if I said I could read your mind, and it'd be probably half a dozen of you went to the door straight away. But when one ever goes into the presence of a saint, it's just there's no fear at all there. Because there isn't. They will never criticize you. Never putting a person down. This one fellow monk in Thailand described it like people walk around as if they have spikes protruding out of their body. Some people got big long spikes, which are very sharp, and you only have to get to within 3 meters or 2 meters of them and you get scratched. You know those sorts of people, you can't come close to them. You feel threatened. And they put you down, they scratch you. They challenge you, they threaten you. There's some people in the world whose spikes are only a foot long. You can come pretty close, but if you get too close, beware, you're going to get hurt. And there's some people who've got no spikes at all. You can come as close as you like and you feel completely safe, completely accepted for who you are. It's a wonderful thing to experience the real meaning of compassion. The door to my heart is always open to me. And if there aren't any saints around, if you haven't got a wonderful husband or wife, at least you have yourself. The very last resort in your own heart, in your own inner being, to remove all the spikes from there so you can come in, you can come close to yourself. When you close your eyes at night to go to sleep, you can go there without any guilt or fear. Just be with yourself at ease, at peace, in love with yourself. It's extremely important to be able to do this. Once we can be kind to ourselves, we can be kind to other people, other beings. And that creates such happiness and joy in our hearts. When I was teaching meditation in the prison farm, the jail, close to our monastery at Serpentine, I used to like teaching there because we used to meet some great characters, sort of characters who would never come to a meditation retreat. And also that they weren't as afraid as meditators in the retreat of monks. They would challenge you and they'd ask really nice questions. Questions which would threaten you. They didn't have that awful respect of a monk sitting up here. Which creates a barrier sometimes between us, doesn't it? This robe and this bald head. But anyway, this one man came to the meditation group one day. I remember this vividly because he was a very tall, thickly built man with a big beard and long, scraggly hair. Young, the sort of person you wouldn't like to meet on the street corner at night time, as they say. You know, it's really tough with the scars to prove it. And I, of quite frankly, my first impression is, what is he doing here in this nice soft meditation group? And when he started speaking, he spoke with a thick Irish accent, very coarse speech, but he came to meditation. He told me why. He actually started telling me his life story. His life story, that he was born in Belfast, and the, you know what the troubles and the violence is like in that city. And he said that when he was 7 years old, that one of the children in the playground drew out a knife and asked him for his dinner money. And he said, "No, I'm not giving you my dinner money." He said, "Give me your dinner money or I'll knife you." And at 7 years old, he thought that he was just bluffing. He said, "No." And the father knifed him in the arm. And so he ran back home, his blood streaming down his arm, crying his eyes out, to his dad. It wasn't working. You know what his dad did? He went to the kitchen, got a knife, gave it to him, told him to stab the other fellow back. And he gave that example to illustrate how he'd been brought up at 7 years old, teaching him to knife other people back. And so he was saying that throughout his whole life, he was probably 25, 26, 27 years old, throughout his whole life he'd been in and out of jails throughout the world through violent crimes. He said as soon as he went to this prison farm, he was one of the first ones to volunteer in the slaughterhouse. And he'd knife people, knifing cows and sheep and pigs. That was nothing to him, that was good fun. Just up to your knees in blood all day. And he was telling me what happened in the slaughterhouse. Probably many of you have seen documentaries. He said this is two stainless steel bars to restrain the animals as they're led in. Because everyone knows that animals know exactly what's going to happen to them. They try and escape, they squeal, they shriek. And so they'd be led in between these iron bars just to keep them still enough so he could shoot them with a concussion gun. So one shot to stun, the other second shot to kill. He did this all day long for many weeks. One to stun, one to kill. Without thinking about it. I mean, you can imagine the history of the fellow, that he didn't really care. Until he said, and when he started talking about this one experience, he kept on saying, it's God's truth, because that's what they say in Northern Ireland. He said that he was slaughtering cows this day, and he said that one cow came in between the stainless steel bars without shrieking, without trying to escape. It walked in very, very slowly. And as it walked in, it lifted its head and stared at this Irishman in the eyes. And it stopped, maintaining eye contact with this slaughterer. And he said, it's God's truth, it's the first time anything like it has ever happened. Every cow, every pig, every sheep had screamed, had tried to escape, had lied for its very life to escape the executioner. But here, the cow came in very slowly and stared. And he said that threw him into confusion. He couldn't point the gun. He didn't know how many seconds, how many minutes, he just stood there just looking at the cow. But he said as he looked at the cow in the eye, God's truth, he said again, just maintaining that eye contact with that cow. He couldn't tear his eyes away. The water welled up in the other eye of the cow and rolled down his cheek. That cow was crying. So he'd never seen anything like it in his life. He said at that point he broke. He threw down the gun and he swore in the thickest of Irish curses that the screws could do whatever they like for him. He's not going to kill that cow or any other cow. or any other being. And he walked away. Another prisoner came up and shot that cow. But he said from that point onwards, he realized what he was doing. That cow was his teacher. That cow gave her life for him. He was a vegetarian now, giving up violence, because he saw the hurt in another being. This is compassion, this is kindness, this is love. It's incredibly powerful. When I started telling these stories, you know what prisoners are like? They said, yeah, that's all very well, but it's all right to be kind and compassionate in a monastery, but this is real life in a prison, in a jail. There's some tough dudes in here. When I started saying this, I said, okay, right. Let's have a challenge. I said, who's the guy you hate most in here? And the prisoner I asked happened to be, he was an ex-millionaire. Actually, he still was a millionaire. He was never fiddling in the books, like many millionaires should be these days. And because he was like a millionaire, a property developer in Perth, that he was given the job of making tea and coffee for the guards, the screws in the administration block. And there was one senior officer there who was in prison slang called a dog. And you know, the dogs, they may have changed the slang now, but dogs were just the very worst of the prison guards, the prison officers. And the people who just go out of their way to abuse their position, to abuse their power, just to make life intolerable for the prisoners. And the sort of things they did, one of the prisoners told me, was that he'd see like the prisoner's wife coming to visit, and the wife and the kids come to visit. As soon as you see this, you get hold of the husband and send him to the other side of the prison farm on an errand. Quite often the prisoners didn't know that their wife and children were coming. He didn't have a telephone call saying, I'm coming today, George. And send him to the other side of it. This was a big prison, many thousands of acres. And of course, as soon as their wife and children would come, the call would go out on the PA system. So the prisoner, so-and-so, your wife and children are here, please come to the meeting place. But of course, he couldn't be found, where is he? And by the time he was found on the other side of the prison, by the time he came back, the time for visiting was over. Sorry, bad luck, better luck next time. That's the sort of thing these guys would do. Not all of them, but just some of these prison officers would just badly abuse their position. There's just no way the prisoners could complain. But anyhow, this particular prison officer, senior officer, was like this. He was one of the dogs. And so I said, this is an excellent opportunity to prove the power of loving kindness. Because you meet this fellow many times a day. Every time you offer him a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, say something kind to him. But don't just say it. Have it come from your heart, otherwise it will have no power. Mean it. Wish him well. And so he did this. Every time he gave him a cup of tea or coffee, he would say, is the tea strong enough for you? Do you want more milk in your coffee? It's a lovely day today outside, isn't it? Do you want another cushion for your chair? He said this again and again and again. And I used to go every couple of weeks to the prison to see how it was going on. And I would always ask, how's it working? He said, this is a whack of time. So the guy just ignores me all the time. He doesn't even turn his head. I really put my heart into making a decent cup of coffee for this guy. And he never ever says thank you or nothing at all. He just ignores me completely, because that's what prison officers do to the prisoners, the criminals. So this went on for about 3 months, and I had to keep on encouraging him. And we got a breakthrough after 3 months. He gave him a cup of coffee one day. Is it sweet enough for you? Do you want some honey? the prison officer said, That mountain was extremely significant. It was the first time he acknowledged the act of kindness. And it certainly encouraged the prisoner. He got a response at last. And it took him another 2 or 3 months until it finally happened. He gave him a cup of tea one day and said, "Is this strong enough for you?" And the senior officer turned round to him and said, "Yes, thank you." And that thank you went all around the prison. The dog should say thank you to a crimp, an unheard of occurrence. But I run my challenge. The power of loving kindness is more strong than anger. I told a story at an old people's home, and one of the old people there told me a story back. He said that when he was very young, a friend of his was living in one of these old asbestos-clad houses, you know, on the stumps, a typical Australian house. And they had a young daughter. And when the young daughter could just speak, when she was 2, 2.5 years old, she used to ask for a saucer of milk. And you know what it was like with children? When they asked these little things, you just give it to them. Give them a saucer of milk. She used to ask for a saucer of milk every day. And the mother thought it was just a childish thing that she was just drinking out of a saucer for some reason or whatever. This went on for quite a few weeks. And the mother being busy, it took a few weeks before she started to wonder, what's her little daughter doing with this saucer of milk? Why does she drink it out of a cup? So she followed the daughter outside. Daughter went outside the house, went to the side of the house, looked underneath the floor, put the saucer of milk there, called, and out came a tiger snake to drink the milk. She'd been doing this for weeks, feeding this tiger snake. Now those of you who are mothers can understand how she felt. Completely freaked out, but there's nothing she could do then. So when her husband came home from work, she told her husband what had happened. And her husband told her, "Don't worry about this. This tomorrow, when the little girl asks for some salt and milk, give it to her again. Don't worry about it, I'll sort this out." So the following day, the little girl again asked for a saucer of milk, went outside to the side of the house, put the saucer of milk down by the side of the house and called out to this tiger snake. And out slithered the tiger snake. And as soon as the tiger snake slithered out from underneath, it was blasted by a shotgun by the husband who was waiting in hiding to kill the snake. So from that point in time on, the little daughter stopped eating. You give her milk, food, you just wouldn't eat it. And they took her to the doctor, there's nothing wrong with her. And it got so bad that they had to take the daughter to hospital, this little 2 or 3 year old girl. And the way that this man put it, she said she just fretted and fretted and fretted. And there was just nothing the hospital could do. She died. 2 or 3 year old child died. And that husband had shot the snake. He might just as well have shot his daughter. So it's a true story of what happens. Now when I heard that story, it was quite obvious to me, it was probably obvious to you. There's no way in the world that tiger snake would have harmed even a hair on that young girl. If you understand compassion, if you understand love, how can that snake ever do any harm whatsoever to a girl who befriended it? This is compassion, this is kindness, this is love. It's incredibly powerful. Buddha we can't change through love. If we try and change them through hate, it just creates more hate, more negativity, doesn't it? The very crucial, important, vital story from the Pali Canon, the scriptures of Buddhism, the king of the gods was away on some business or other. And in his main hall, his throne room, whatever you wish to call it, there was all his servants and courtiers and ministers and everyone else carrying on the business of that particular heaven realm. And into the very heart of this heaven realm entered this awful demon. Very ugly, stinking, smelly. It's really hard on the nose. Extremely offensive in every possible way. And he walked into this room, he sat right down on the throne, the very chair, the king of the gods. And as soon as he did this, the other servants and attendants said, "Get out of here! You don't belong here. You should have a wash before you come in." And every time they said something cruel to this demon, it grew an inch bigger. And that just made them really incensed. They said, "Get out of here! We've told you time and again, when our king comes back, he's really going to sort you out. You better leave while you've still got a chance. Get out!" They started raising their fists and getting angrier and angrier. And every angry word, every angry action they performed, the demon got an inch bigger. This had been going on for quite a long time when the king of the gods came back from his business. And by this time the demon was extremely smelly, huge, offensive, sitting in the chair, taking up almost half the hall. But the king of the gods, the reason why he was king of the gods, was he was smart. He knew exactly what was going on. And he said, "Welcome, demon. Why have you waited so long to visit me? Do you want a cup of tea? I've had a cup of coffee. Is it too hot for you? And some sandwiches?" And he snapped his fingers and he told all his servants to bring cushions. And he got down and started massaging the demon's feet. And every kind word, every kind action he said or did towards the demon, he got an inch smaller. But when the other attendants and the servants and courtiers saw this, they understood what needed to be done, and so they rushed around getting sandwiches and getting cups of tea and fruit juice and fanning him if he was too hot, or getting him dry if he was too cold, and scratching his feet, looking after him in every conceivable way. And every kind word, every kind act, this demon got an inch smaller. So much so that eventually the demon was faded completely away. And that was the end of the story in the Sanghita Nikaya, the Tipitaka. And that's a lovely story. They say that that was a demon which fed on anger, an anger-eating demon. We all have those demons inside of us. And outside of us as well, beings which feed on our anger and get bigger and bigger and bigger the more we give them anger. And sometimes it's very difficult not to, because they become offensive. The prison warder who just mistreats and maltreats the prisoners, he deserves to be angry, the sort of things he does. But the more you get angry at him, the bigger inch by inch he grows in negativity. The person who is your enemy at work, the person you can't get on with, he too is probably, or she, is an anger-eating demon. If you get angry at them, they get more angry back at you. How about the things in our minds? Our own thoughts. They are also anger-eating demons. If we get angry at them, they get worse and worse and worse. Bigger and bigger and bigger. So, these anger-eating demons which can torture us, they only subside through kindness, through love. When I did a meditation on loving-kindness, I start with a visualization. I close my eyes. And I happen to like cats. So I visualize a small kitten. I visualize that kitten and say to myself, this kitten's got no one else in the world to look after it. So if it's come before me, just lost, without a mother, without a father, without a home, it's small and fluffy. If you prefer dogs, imagine a small puppy. If it's a baby, small little baby, just helpless. And I know that that kitten or that puppy or that baby, if I don't look after it, if I don't care for it, if I don't give it food, warmth, shelter and love, it's going to die. You know what it's like when a baby is just born. If it's not cuddled within the first day or 2 days or something, it dies. Even though that it's otherwise healthy, that it needs love to survive, to live. Just as that small kitten and puppy does. And I find it very helpful in this meditation to imagine the little kitten, the little puppy, or the little baby keeping eye contact with me. Just as that cow in that story of the slaughterhouse kept eye contact with the big Irishman, to keep eye contact with the little puppy in your mind, the little kitten, the little baby, and start to feel oneself becoming soft, caring, looking after. Because one feels one has to. Without you, this being would die, would be in pain. Then after, when that happens, I start to feel the sensation of kindness and compassion. Not as a thought, not as an idea or an ideal, but as a feeling. Can you feel that in your heart now? Down here, not in your head. In the meditation on loving kindness, we have to take our attention away from our head. It's not a thought, it's not a philosophy, it's an idea, it's a feeling, it's a sensation. It's usually situated around the heart, the chest. Can you feel what it's like to love? The kindness, the caring, the sort of feeling which makes your eyes all wet. That's a feeling of love and kindness, compassion. And I encourage that feeling. I dwell on it. When you dwell on anything, it grows. If you dwell on anger, it grows. If you dwell on love and kindness, it grows. Until this feeling of love and kindness is quite strong around my chest. And then, just like a slide projector, I change the image from the little kitten to myself. And I notice this very little difference between me and that small being. I too am vulnerable in this world. If I don't look after me, I'm going to hurt. I'm going to have pain. I'm going to have hunger and cold. I have to care about my body and my heart. Loving oneself doesn't mean one holds oneself up as being anything special. It's not an ego trip, it's just care. To look after myself, to make sure I have enough to eat, that I don't sit too long and hurt my legs or my knees. I don't push myself so far and so hard as a monk. I don't burn myself out so I'm of no use to anyone else. So when I make mistakes, I can forgive them very easy. I never mind, but you're just a human being. You're just a person. You will make mistakes. What do you expect anyway of yourself? Sometimes you give a talk and it works. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you sit and you fall asleep. Sometimes you sit and you're quiet. You're a being. Never mind, but sitting up here trying to inspire everyone, you fail. Never mind. I couldn't do this if I wasn't kind to myself. So you forgive yourself, be kind to yourself, because it's very, very important. If I couldn't do that to myself, I would die. And you know that The feeling of loving kindness is always the same in there. It's in my heart. It just depends on where I turn it to. It's like a flashlight. You can turn it on the wall, on the notice board, on the floor, on the ceiling. It's the same feeling within you, the same power. It just depends on how you use it, where it goes to. Sometimes, for meditators, it's very hard to feel loving kindness towards oneself. In this Western world, we're told that the last thing we should do is to be kind to ourselves, to forgive ourselves, to love ourselves. We're afraid to love ourselves. We can forgive other people, but not ourselves. If I could open up your hearts and show them to everyone else, you know how hard you've been on yourself. People would keep on saying, don't be so hard, don't be so cruel, forgive yourself, let yourself be as you are, there's no need to be any different. You're okay, as you are.
No, I'm not.
We need our thoughts, they're extremely important. They create the texture which becomes beauty in life. So being kind and caring to ourselves is accepting ourselves. The door of my heart is open to me just as I am. I can be enlightened today, this moment, without changing anything, without giving up all my hang-ups. Why not be enlightened now? Accepting yourself as you are. Loving oneself. Having the boundless compassion of a Buddha to oneself, first of all. And once you get that love going towards yourself, then you can start changing the picture in the Svarthi check to put your husband or your wife, someone very close to you, and realize how vulnerable they are to how sensitive, how much they need love.
Talking about meditation, loving kindness, and compassion, we heard the Venerable Ajahn Brahmavamsa, a Buddhist monk. His talk was recorded during a meditation retreat in Adelaide last year. And we'll hear more from Ajahn Brahmavamsa in some future editions of Inner Space. On ABC FM Stereo, you are listening to Inner Space with Yaroslav Kovalchuk.